The day dawned cold and overcast in Budapest. It was October 1944. The loading docks at the railroad station were bustling with activity that day, as they had been for a number of weeks previously and as they continued to be for a number of weeks yet to come. As the cattle cars sat on the siding by the loading docks with their loading ramps down, it was not cattle they were loading that day. Rather, there were several hundred Jews who were lined up on that particular day to be loaded in, 40 people to a car, and transported across the heartland of Central Europe on their way to be part of the Third Reich's final solution. Now, on that particular day in October 1944, a dynamic young Italian who had recently obtained a bogus diplomatic passport from a friendly Spanish ambassador drove up to that particular loading dock that day, drove up in a chauffeur-driven limousine that bore the insignia and the license plate of the Hungarian Spanish legation. As this young man got out of the car and looked at this line of people, he was absolutely appalled by what he saw. And as he watched these people being herded on to the cattle cars to be transported, he noticed two young children all bundled up against the crisp fall weather. Two young children that appeared to be about 12 years of age. Young children that he took to be identical twins. He was particularly moved by the sight of these two young children, and acting quickly and impulsively, he simply ordered them to get out of the line and into his car. Well, now this action was immediately noted by the SS colonel who was in charge of loading the cars, and there followed a very quick and heated exchange. But this particular young man very audaciously and boldly bluffed his way through this confrontation, even though the SS colonel that he confronted, he later learned, was a man by the name of Adolf Eichmann. But he bluffed his way through this confrontation, and he left the loading dock with his two frightened young Jewish children in tow there in the limousine. Now, these two youngsters proved to be only the first of over 5,000 Jews whose lives Giorgio Priscalla directly, personally intervened to save over the next 4 months. These particular 4 months, between the fall of 1944 and the late winter of 1945, Giorgio Priscalla audaciously met and was directly responsible for saving the lives of over 5,000 individuals while he carried out this masquerade. Now, the twins that marked the beginning of his personal mission to rescue and save as many as he could, these twins and several thousand others like them were in a state of captivity. They were being propelled to a destruction from which they were powerless to deliver themselves. A destruction they were powerless to escape until they were called out and offered salvation, a physical salvation, but a salvation nevertheless. In much the same way, all of us today are in a state or have been a part of a world that is described in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 26, a world that is described as in the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will. just as truly as these individuals were called out and given an opportunity to escape from that captivity, so also have all of us been. A world of which we have been a part, a world that is described as being held captive by Satan himself, a world that is inexorably moving toward oblivion, except it be for the intervention of a powerful unseen hand, the hand of Almighty God. Now, just as those two young Jewish children and the many hundreds and hundreds of others who were to follow were given a chance to be saved from death and destruction, so today, all of us, so today, our young people, children, teenagers, of whatever age, are being given a certain opportunity. They're being called to step out of the line that ends with a one-way trip to oblivion and destruction, and to take part in a salvation. A salvation that has both a physical and a spiritual aspect. The salvation that Giorgio Priscalla offered to those young Jews in Budapest 45 years ago was very real and very tangible. Because it was very real and very tangible to the individuals to whom it was offered, it was highly prized and valued. Because it was recognized for what it was. It was highly prized and valued because it was recognized for what it was. This morning, I would like to help all of us, but particularly our young people. I would like to help our young people to have made a little more real to them the salvation that God offers. Those young Jews, 45 years ago in Budapest, attached great value to what Giorgio Priscalla offered them. They attached great value to it because it was very real. If we are today to attach great value, if our young people are to attach great value to what they are offered, it must first seem and be to them real. Now, we use the term salvation, we talk about salvation. What do we mean salvation? Salvation from what? Well, we often think of the expression in Matthew chapter 24, verse 22, a statement that is has been very often quoted, and one with which most of us are familiar, at least when we hear it quoted. Jesus talked about a time of great tribulation, a time of great anguish, a time of great trial, a time of great and horrible events that were going to occur, and he said that these things would be worse than anything that had ever occurred in the world up to that present time, known or ever again should be. And he said in verse 22 of Matthew 24 that except those days should be shortened, there would no flesh be saved. And the sense of it is that no flesh would be saved alive, that there is a saving of flesh, a physical salvation, being saved from death. So Jesus talked of events that were going to escalate. He talked of a time when it would be possible that except for divine intervention, there would simply not be flesh left alive on the planet. Now, we live in a world where we take weapons of mass destruction for granted. Our young people have never lived in a world where it was not possible for man to destroy himself. We live in a world that is confronted by many problems and many traumas and many tragedies. Our young people have seen right in their own living room, right on the television, events going on around the world. Events that certainly confront all of us with the serious state of things in this world in which we now live. We're in a world that is a frightening world to many, many people. Whether you're looking at problems of the increasing fracturing that is taking place all over the world today, in nations in Europe and Africa and Asia, continuing fracturing and fragmenting that's taking place all over the world and in this very nation in which we live, many nations increasingly are becoming absolutely ungovernable. We live in a world in which a dictator is able to arise and able to have for himself weapons of mass destruction. We live in what can be a very, very frightening world. A world in which there are diseases that modern technology and science seems unable to deliver humanity from. A world that is a frightening world, a world that Jesus Christ said would continue to escalate, that unless there was an intervention to step in, there would no flesh be saved. But you know, that's not really all that is talked about in the context of salvation. It's not simply a matter that we live in a frightening world, that we live in a world that many people find very frightening and very overwhelming. We also live in a world that many people find very empty, very futile, very frustrating. This is something that is increasingly faced by many of our young people, because many find that in the society and in the schools in which they go, there are very, very many who have no real sense of purpose, who find that there is an emptiness and a certain futility in the world. There is a book in the Bible that was traditionally read at this particular time of the year, read at the Feast of Tabernacles by the Jews, and still is in Orthodox synagogues. There is a particular theme to this book, the book of Ecclesiastes, that can be summarized with just a few verses, but it fits in a very important way to a message that God wants us to grasp, that God wants us to perceive, that He wants young and old to understand, and that needs to be emphasized at this time of year. Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon, and Solomon was an individual who was a great experimenter. Solomon was an individual that wanted to understand about life. He wanted to understand about how things worked and why they worked. He was an individual that had a lot of questions. He was an individual that came to be very frustrated by certain things that he saw. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes really provides a summary of Solomon's experiments. Solomon performed a lot of experiments, and he recorded these. He said in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 13, he says, "I gave my heart to seek and search out wisdom concerning all the things that are done under heaven. This sore travail has God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith." He said, "I set my mind to understand what life was all about, to understand this period of trouble, of difficulty, of labor, of effort, of toil, that seemingly God has given people to go through, to live, to be exercised and developed by. I looked at this world. I looked at what it offered. I looked at what it held out. And I wanted to understand why we go through the problems and the difficulties and why so much seems so futile and so empty. He said, I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. I looked at everything I could see, and as I looked at it, as I worked with it, as I thought about it, as I tried and experimented with various things, I came to conclude that there was an emptiness. There was an emptiness. Solomon tried many things. I'm not going to go through all of the various things that he tried, but he tells in verse 10 that whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I withheld not from my heart from any joy. What would it take to make you happy? You know, you ask most people, you ask a lot of young people, what do you want out of life? You say, well, I want to be happy. I want to have a happy life. I want to be happy. I want to have fun. I want to do things. I want to go places. I want to experience life. I want to be happy. Well, that's great. What'll make you happy? What'll make you happy? The Constitution of the United States talks about people of this nation being granted the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness. And of course, that's what a lot of people do, is they pursue happiness all their lives. I've dealt and counseled with many people who find their lives in places that they never expected them to be. You know, we don't set out, our young people don't set out with the idea in mind that what I really desire out of life is a mess. You know, what I'd really like is to find myself with a mess, to find everything falling apart, to find myself in all kinds of circumstances that are difficult and tragic and hard to cope with. Nobody sets out to get in a mess. But rather, people set out to be happy. They want to be happy. They want to have fun. And they look at things that seem to be fun, that seem to be exciting, that seem to hold out opportunities. And they pursue those opportunities because they perceive them as leading to what they want and desire. Now Solomon said, I looked at things and I took note and I decided I want to find out what makes for a happy life. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to have fun. And I decided that I was going to perform an experiment and see what worked. Said, what is it that'll make happy? What is it that'll make happiness? Is it to acquire a lot of learning? He talks about in verse 1 or chapter 1. The acquisition of a lot of wisdom. And he studied many subjects. Solomon pursued learning. He pursued scholarship. He decided that wasn't all there was to life. He decided to have fun. Chapter 2, I said to myself, I'm going to prove you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to party. I'm going to have fun. He did that. He pursued all sorts of things. He went the party route. He gave himself to wine, using wine as an intoxicating beverage, as a means to seek to create a chemically induced state of euphoria. That somehow didn't solve things. He tried great accomplishments. He set out to build great things, set in motion great plans. He pursued all sorts of things. He made money and acquired more and more. He got everything he could think of. In fact, he said in verse 10, "Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I withheld not from my heart from any joy. I did everything I could think of." In verse 12, "As I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do that comes after the king, even that which has already been done?" Solomon said, "Hey, you want to perform an experiment? There's nothing you can try I haven't already tried. I had resources available to me that allowed me to pursue everything imaginable. So I pursued all kinds of things. I tried it all. And I could see certain things. I could see that there was relative value, that wisdom exceeds folly. I could see certain things were better than other things. But I could also see that there was a futility and an emptiness. That when I pursued these things after a while and I was able to get it, somehow it wasn't everything I anticipated it to be. In fact, Solomon came to a point in verse 17 of chapter 2 where he says, I hated life. Because everything seemed to be vanity. It seemed to be emptiness. It seemed to be frustrating. And I was very frustrated, Solomon says. Now, a little bit of why that is the case is explained a little further in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. Most of the English translations are not real clear with this particular verse. But if we look at it, and it's already been partially commented on earlier in a previous sermon. But we're told in verse 10 of Ecclesiastes chapter 3, "I have seen the travail, the toil, the labor, the effort that God has given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. I've seen the things that people go through in life. That God has made everything beautiful in His time. Also, He has set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God has made from the beginning to the end." Now, what is translated world here in verse 11 is a Hebrew word, olam. It would best be rendered eternity, as it is rendered in other places. That is normally the sense that it is used in the Bible, in the sense of ages or of eternity. God has set, it says, eternity in their heart. Well, what does that mean? Well, as the Jewish commentary, the Sansino, brings out, God has endowed man with a sense of the future. You think about that for a second. Man is endowed with something that animals don't have. Solomon looked at what seemed to be the similarity between man and beast. We all breathe the same air, and we all die the same death. We experience right now, we go through, we live a temporary, physical, transitory existence. Animals are born, they mature, they grow, they develop, they age, they die. They return back to the elements from whence they came. Human beings do the same thing. They're born, they grow, they mature, they develop. They begin to gradually run down, to age, to decay, to die, and to return from the elements, to the elements from whence they came. And yet there's something about man that is distinct from animals. Now, there are things, you know, animals do many things. Animals can experience pain and pleasure, even certain emotions. An animal can be happy or can be excited or can be frustrated. An animal can experience various emotions. An animal can be taught to do certain things. It's incredible, you know, you read about some of the things that animal trainers can train an animal to do. You see some of the experiments that have been done with chimpanzees and with apes. And you realize that certainly there are many things that can be conveyed or taught or trained in an animal. But there's something that's focused on here in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 in verse 11 that is unique to human beings. You know, if you were to be asked, any of you, young, old, whomever, what is it that really sets man apart from the animals? It's not the experience of pain or pleasure. It's not even the experience of various emotions, various feelings. But you see, what an animal does not have is a concept of time, a concept of the future. An animal cannot conceive of that which has not been. Dream of it, conceive of it, bring it into being. God has endowed man with a sense of the future. Man knows that he is more than a creature of the day. He is more than the creature of a day, and this consciousness is a cause of his dissatisfaction with the transitory experiences which take place within the span of his lifetime. You see, human beings can realize that there is something beyond today. We not only have a memory of yesterday, we can conceive of tomorrow. And as time goes by and as we do various things, we realize that there's got to be more. There's a frustration, an emptiness and a futility that many feel. God has set within us a sense of the future, a desire for something more than this present, temporary, transitory state. God has set before us something far greater. He has set before us a valuable salvation. A valuable salvation, a saving out that is of great value. Those young Jews in Budapest 45 years ago understood what it meant to be saved, to be called out of a line that was a one-way trip to destruction. And to be given an opportunity for life, for fulfillment, for the achievement of all the things that are important and significant to human beings. They understood how valuable that opportunity was because they grasped what they were in danger of losing. And by contrast, they grasped, and as the years have gone by, have grasped more and more, undoubtedly, the value of that gift that they were given. It is important that we as parents convey to our children the value of what it is that God offers. Now, how do we do that? The parents have a very important role because the parents have a crucial role in the transmission of values. Value is the worth that we attach to something. It is the comparative worth and value that we attach.
It's very important that we as parents convey to our children the relative worth of what they see around. Now, how do we do this? It's not simply a matter of sitting down and lecturing them and preaching at them. Let's understand that what our children see, they imitate and copy. Children are great copycats. What they see, they imitate. What they imitate, they practice. What they practice, they become. What we see, we imitate. What we imitate, we practice. What we practice, we become. If we're going to transmit values, we must hold those values in our life and exemplify them. You know, the world places value on certain things. Now, the world doesn't place a lot of value on God's salvation. It doesn't place much value on what God offers. The world has lost sight of what God offers. Attaches very little value and very little thought to it. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15, we're told, love not the world. Don't attach great value to this world, this age, this society, neither the things that compose it, because the values of this world are an antithesis to the values of God. Verse 16, for all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. The world passes away. The world is transitory. The world is doomed to a temporary existence. This age, the world in the sense not of the physical earth, but of this age, this time, this set of values, it's temporary, it's transitory, it's passing. The value system of this world is based, it's predicated on what does it feel like, what does it look like, and to what extent is it going to impress other people. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. What does it feel like? What does it look like? To what extent are others going to be impressed? Those are the things that the world attaches value to, and these are the things, the means that the world tells our young people and tells all of us, these are the things the world says are of value. What do you have? What brand is on your shoes or your clothes, your shirt, your pants, your car? What do you have? What do you look like? How's the skin stretched over your face? What do you look like? What do you have? These are the things that the world attaches great value to. A very temporary, very transitory set of values. The things that you have, the physical possessions can be wiped out many ways, many times. Many of those Jews that were in that line, Giorgio Priscalla stepped in and saved out of it, had gone from being very prosperous individuals, individuals with a great deal of physical possession, individuals with prominence and respect and esteem in the community, individuals with many things that we would say are very valuable. Those things were gone. Those things were gone. And now their life was on the line. Their perspective on what was really valuable began to change a little bit. God tells us that the values of this present time, the values of this age are temporary. They're transitory. If we latch onto them, if we lock into them, then we're locking into a passing, fading set of values, a society that will not endure, that will not be preserved. Now, there are things that we need to attach value to, and we as parents need to attach appropriate value, because the only values that we're going to transmit to our children are the values that we ourselves deeply hold. If the value system we hold is this world's corrupt set of values, that's the only values we will be capable of transmitting. We've got to see those values for what they are. We've got to value other things. What should we value? First and foremost, we need to value God's calling. It's not a matter of just saying the words. It's not a matter of simply telling our children certain words. It's a matter of what we believe and what we live in our lives. How valuable is God's calling to us? How precious is it? How much do we cherish it? And do we value it? To what extent do we take it for granted? Do we treat it lightly and carelessly? Do we take for granted the knowledge and the understanding that God has given us? Or in some cases, kind of begrudge it. Well, you know, I've heard people express, you know, well, you know, if it weren't for tithing, I'd be able to do this or do that. If it weren't for the fact that I couldn't work on the Sabbath, boy, I could, this great job and this opportunity, and it's like, you know, if God hadn't somehow kind of stuck me with this, boy, I could have really done great things in life. Really gone a long ways. It conveys a certain value. How much do we value God's calling? How much do we value our mate? You know, we hear a lot about various types of abuse in our world. We hear about physical abuse and sexual abuse and verbal abuse and mental abuse and emotional abuse and all sorts of abuse. And most of us, as we hear of certain things, we hear of something like child abuse, we're appalled. We think that's horrible. That's terrible. Well, it is. But to what extent do we really attach value? How do we value our mates, and how do we convey that value? Because you see, we're conveying something to our children in terms of what's valuable. How do we speak of our mate and to our mate? We live in a time, we live in an age where more and more people are frustrated. They're frustrated with their state in life. They're frustrated with the state of things. We see all sorts of social turmoil. All sorts of social turmoil because people don't feel fulfilled. They don't feel appreciated. There was a time when people in the world, in society, in the Western world, and it's still the case, of course, in certain areas of the world that are what anthropologists would term traditional societies, where an individual knew his place in the world and recognized a contribution of value he was able to make, took satisfaction, derived pleasure and satisfaction from that contribution, and sought to fulfill it. We live in a society that has been undergoing, in the period of the most rapid time of social change and transition that has ever occurred within so short a time span. A lot of times, people have lost sight of the proper value of their contribution. A lot of the problems that we have in families, come from the fact of husbands failing to convey to their wives the value of their contribution. Women's lib would not be the problem that it is in society today
Because there is a void, there's a vacuum. You know, nature abhors a vacuum in their attempts to fill these vacuums. There would not be the problems that we have in our society that are ripping the family unit apart if the wives and the mothers of this land felt valued by their husbands and by their children as God values them. I think we have to recognize that in many cases we have failed and neglected to convey proper value to our mates. We can take one another for granted. We can disparage the contribution, but you see, the greatest fulfillment and satisfaction we're going to have as human beings is going to be the fulfillment of what God designed us to be. To the extent we comply with and fulfill the manufacturer's instructions, that we follow the instruction manual that came with the product from the manufacturer, that's God's word that he sent with us. To the extent that we conform to that, to the extent that we fit with that and fulfill that, we're going to have a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment and achievement. We're going to have the opposite of a sense of frustration and futility. But you see, if we're taught, and we're continually bombarded by society, because who is the motivator of this society? From whence and from whom does the value system of this society derive?
Car you drive, it does not derive from the color of your skin. It does not derive from your education. It does not derive from the brand of clothes that you wear. Your value does not derive from any of those things. Your value, your intrinsic value, derives from God who made man in his own image. God made man in his own image with the potential of ultimately being born into his family. And God values us. He values you and me. He values your children and my children to the extent that he brings out in John chapter 3, verse 16, "For God so loved the world." God attached such value to humanity that he gave his only begotten Son. He gave the sacrifice of Jesus Christ to attest to us, to witness to us, to generations past and generations to come, to attest to the value that he attaches to us and to having us as a part of his family to share life with him. God attaches great value. Value that you and I cannot really begin to conceive and to perceive the extent of how deeply God values us. You know, John tells us that it is through this that we perceive the love of God. Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. God attaches great value to us, to you and to me. We need to convey to our children that appropriate value, that basis of proper and appropriate self-respect. You know, the Apostle Paul quoted that. He said in 1 Corinthians, when he talked about the certain types of really self-destructive behaviors, he talked about particularly in the context of immorality, but the principle applies to all self-destructive behaviors. You know, Paul talked about that gave as a basis for avoiding immorality. He says, "What? Know you not? Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit which you have of God. You are not your own. You're bought with a price. Glorify God in your body." If you attach the value to that God attaches, if you have the level of self-respect that God would have you have, recognizing that your body is the temple of God's Holy Spirit. There are things you simply don't do because there is an appropriate value and respect that is internalized there. We live in a world that is an increasingly dysfunctional world. Our Western society is replete with what are termed dysfunctional families. Families that never learn to function the way God intended them to be. Mr. DeCotch Jr. referred to that and made comment about it in the film that we saw earlier this feast. Whether we're talking in the context of chemical abuse, of alcohol abuse, various other various types of drugs and mind-altering chemicals, whether we're looking in terms of immorality or the various other compulsive, addictive types of behaviors, destructive behaviors, self-destructive behaviors. It's important for us to realize and to perceive and to convey to our children that there is a value. There is a value that we have. There's a value we have to God. There's a value that we need to convey that is a basis of proper and appropriate self-respect. Realizing we have a potential that God has given us. And we can do something about achieving that and accomplishing it. This world is filled with false messiahs. Many, in some cases individuals, in other cases movements that have come through the course of human history, have held out the solution to man's problems, and yet, inevitably, the so-called solution has just further continued the decline. Jesus talked about, you know, in Matthew 24, that many would come in His name, that many would come saying, I am Christ, I am the Messiah, the Savior. The history of humanity has been replete with false messiahs and false saviors, individuals and movements that held out the promise of, quote, salvation. Oh, they may not have used or said it in religious terms. We're in a secular society, and so we tend to use secular terms. But it comes down to the same thing. Even Hitler promised the German people not 6 years of war and destruction. He promised them a 1,000-year Reich. That's what he promised. Now, what he delivered was 6 years of misery and destruction on this earth and on Europe in particular, that led to the death of literally millions upon millions of people. But the world is full of false messiahs. We find many movements in our Western society that have as their aim really the promise of deliverance from futility, from emptiness. They're false messiahs. Many of the social movements that are transforming, in reality destroying our family unit, because just as truly we read in the Scriptures of Israel of old sacrificing their children on the fires of Molech, and we read it and we are appalled, and we think, how could human beings pass their little children through the fire to Molech? And yet, brethren, just as surely as Israel of old, following the example of Gentile nations around, just as surely as they passed their children through the fire to Molech, as they sacrificed their children to false gods, just as surely have we in our modern Western world sacrificed our children, sacrificed a generation upon the altar of the god of materialism. We have sowed the wind and we are reaping the whirlwind. Our society is replete with false messiahs. Various movements, various social movements, various individuals and movements that have been launched by them that hold out the promise of deliverance and fulfillment. These are one-way tickets. But brethren, if we buy some of those one-way tickets, our children are going to catch right onto the train. They're going to jump aboard too. They're not going to know it's a one-way ticket because the devil never advertises anything for what it is. He does not believe in truth and packaging. So all of these movements, they all portray themselves as the solutions. And yet they're just another way to be wrong. The world is filled with false messiahs. Parents have a very valuable role in transmitting values, in transmitting to our children what is of value. And our children and our young people have an important role in cultivating and appreciating that. Did you realize, young people, that there was a time when everybody was in the church? You know, there was a time in man's history. I'm not talking about Adam and Eve in the garden either. There was a time in man's history when everybody was, quote, in the church. Everybody attended Sabbath services. Everybody did the same things. Sure there was. You read of it. In the book of Genesis, yes. You read of it at the time, the aftermath of the flood of Noah. There were 8 people that were saved. That was the population of the world at that time. 8 people. Noah, Ms. Noah, the 3 little Noahs, and their wives. Only they weren't so little anymore. 8 people. I'm going to tell you what, I bet when Noah held Sabbath services on board the ark, that he didn't have trouble getting everybody to show up. You know, about that time, nobody asked the question, does God exist? See, everybody believed. They got off the boat and they believed. Everybody in the world knew the truth. Had access to the truth. And yet, according to the story of Genesis, within 100 years of that event, mankind was following Nimrod, building the Tower of Babel. How do we come from one spot to the other in so short a period of time? It is the same way that individuals can make a progression in their own mind. It is the same progression that has taken many of our young people out of God's church, those who have chosen to leave. There is a progression that will take you out. It is the progression that the world of old underwent. You see, we're told in Romans chapter 1 and verse 21 that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became as fools. Now, there's a progression when they knew God. There was a time they knew God. Those here know God, at least have an opportunity to. Our young people being brought up and taught God's truth, they have a knowledge of God. They have a knowledge of the truth. But you see, if when we know God, we don't glorify Him as God, neither are thankful. So there's a progression. If we don't value, if we do not appreciate and value the calling that God has given us, if we don't value and appreciate what God offers, if we treat it cheaply, if we treat it casually and carelessly, we're not thankful for it, we don't appreciate it, there is a progression. If we take it for granted, if we take what God offers, if we take the knowledge of God for granted, if we take the knowledge of God for granted, it leads us down a road where we began a direction. It talks about here that their foolish heart was darkened. In other words, there was a filling of our mind with ideas and concepts that lead to futility and frustration. The heart and mind becomes filled with ideas, with attitudes that really are not enlightening, they're darkening. They lead to futility, they lead to frustration. And the smarter people begin to think themselves, the more foolish they become. They change the center from creator-centered to creature-centered. That's what it talks about in verse 23. Change the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and beasts, creatures. Left a perspective on life that was centered around the Creator and became centered instead on the creation, on the creature. Traded a spiritual perspective for a materialistic perspective. They began to give their worship, that is, their devotion, their allegiance, their loyalty. They began to value the wrong things. And it leads right on down. It leads into immorality. It leads into all sorts of self-destructive behaviors, because when we depart from the way of the living God, ultimately those behaviors are self-destructive, some more quickly so than others. There's a progression that it gives right here in Romans chapter 1 that described, as Paul was writing here to the church at Rome, he described the progression that had brought the classical world, the Greek and Roman world, that prided itself in its knowledge. There was a progression that had brought them to the point they were. But brethren, that is not unique. That's not unique to that time and that age. It's not unique, young people, to what happened after the flood to the first and second generation that were born to humanity. It is a progression that can take part, that can take place in the heart and mind of any person who does not value and appreciate what God offers. If we cease to value it and if we cease to be thankful and appreciative for it, we can start on a progression where we began to treat it cheaply and casually. We began to take it for granted. We began to lose the understanding and the grasp that we have, and we exchange that for a system of thinking that leads to futility and frustration in the long term, that leads to a creature-centered, a materialistic perspective that eventually degenerates down into behaviors that are very self-destructive. God's salvation is a valuable salvation. It's not some vague heaven. It's not a matter of floating around on clouds. It certainly involves the aspect of physical protection. You know, Christ said it's not wrong to desire to be protected from the time of God's, the events of the tribulation, the events of the day of the Lord. Talks about in Zephaniah chapter 2 and in verse 3. Talks about the fact that, seek you the Lord, all you meek of the earth, which have wrought His judgment, seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be you shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Christ is going to come back, and there is going to be a literal and a physical salvation, a saving of life on the planet. But God's salvation goes far beyond that, much further than that. There's something a lot more that's involved. Yes, it talks about in Micah, it talks about the many of the things that we've already heard describe this feast. Talks about the new world that God is going to build. You know, sometimes our young people look at it and they think, well, you know, what's really in it? I mean, you know, I want life. I want life that's exciting. I want life that's fulfilling. I want to have fun. I want to have fun. Now, there's nothing wrong with having fun. In Psalm 16 and verse 11, David writes, "You," speaking of God, "you will show me the path of life. In your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore." In God's presence is fullness of joy. At His right hand are pleasures forevermore. You ever think about that? You ever think about that, young people? You think God just kind of sits there and He never cracks a smile, He never has fun, and nobody there has fun, and nobody smiles, and nobody's happy. They just kind of sit around. You know, the world's concept. They talk about going to heaven, and their concept's kind of floating around in the clouds and playing harps. Now, that sounds real exciting and appealing, right? I mean, everybody is real anxious. That's why you have such great attendance at harp concerts. I mean, obviously, that really appeals to people, doesn't it? People just, breaking the doors down to get into a harp concert. That's why they want to spend forever just kind of plucking on a harp. I'm not criticizing harp music. I'm simply making the point that what the world says that they anticipate is really not what they look forward to. In fact, what the world describes is about as boring as what they can conceive. That's not the reality that God offers. God says, in His presence is fullness of joy. At His right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. You think God does not enjoy life? You think God is bored? You think God looks down and says, "Boy, I wish I were a teenager. They have all the fun." What about it, young people? You think God looks down and says, "Well, let me ask you this. If you're 16 or 17, do you look at somebody who's 3 and 4 and you say, 'Boy, you know, I wish I were 3 and 4 because they get to have all the fun?'" They do all these exciting things. They get on this tricycle and they race down the sidewalk. They get on this little rocky horse and they, you know, go up and down. Boy, those were the good old days. You think God looks down and He wishes He were a teenager, or He wishes He were an adult? God's presence is fullness of joy, and at His right hand there are pleasures forevermore. God has things in store for us that are beyond our ability to conceive. But you see, God offers us not the futility. Solomon looked at the lesson of Ecclesiastes. Solomon looked at a world that was wrapped up with frustration and futility. He saw a world that was transitory, that was temporary. He saw a world that in so many ways, the life that people lived, there was a sense of emptiness, there was a sense of futility. God's salvation is a deliverance from that emptiness and that futility, from that frustration. In Romans chapter 8, in verse 19, "For the earnest expectation of the creation waits for the manifestation of the sons of God, because the creation was made subject to vanity." That's what Solomon talked about in Ecclesiastes. It was made subject to vanity, subject to being transitory, temporary, passing away. "Not willingly, but by reason of Him who subjected the same in hope." God did so on the basis of a hope of what lay ahead, because the creation itself will be delivered from the bondage of corruption, from being in bondage to decay, from being bound to decay, and delivered into the glorious liberty of the children of God. The answer to the vanity, the futility, the emptiness, the frustration, the temporary, transitory, futile, frustrating existence that characterizes so much of human life, the answer to that is the deliverance, the salvation that God speaks of right here in Romans chapter 8. It is something of great value. It is something that is priceless. It's not emptiness and frustration and futility. No, the presence of God their joys forevermore. At His right hand, their pleasures that stretch on out into eternity. Because we see a world that will be delivered from what binds it to decay and deterioration and futility and frustration, and will be delivered into glorious liberty and freedom of the children of God. God offers us salvation, deliverance. It is of great value. It's important that all of us, young and old, attach that value to it.